What's up, everybody? My guests today are Shannon Green and Christy Peterson of the Indie Craft Experience right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Indie Craft Experience was founded in 2005, and this year is celebrating its 15th birthday. So congrats to Shannon and Christy. Shannon and Christy, both super, super warm, very kind, brilliant people, in my opinion, who have created a company that brings creators, crafters, makers, and presents them and their work to the public and to Atlanta, and allows them to sell and to get connected with people who love buying from them. Indie Craft Experience has 5 markets throughout the year, 4 seasonal markets, as well as a holiday shopping spectacular at the this year is at the Georgia World Congress Center, and that is in November of every year. And you should seriously go check it out, because it is, I mean, you know, in 2 days you could literally knock out, in one day, hell, in one day, you could knock out pretty much all of your holiday shopping if you wanted to. So over 170 or something vendors over 2 days this year at the Georgia World Congress Center in November. Be on the lookout for that, as well as doing markets. Shannon and Christy have been doing a lot of workshops out of their studio in Candler Park, as well as getting into doing these retreats for makers. So they're about to go to Oregon, and they're going to be doing a week-long dyeing retreat, and then later going to Oaxaca, Mexico later in the year. So if you're interested in any of that, go check them out online, listen to the show to hear more about what they're doing, how they're expanding Indie Craft Experience beyond markets and workshops, and getting more into experiential and cultural things for people to have opportunities to make and connect with the things that they make, and to just get back to where things come from and being able to make things with their hands. So thank you, Shannon and Christy, for creating Indie Craft Experience. Thank you for coming onto the show. Congratulations on 15 years. And without further ado, here is my episode with Shannon Green and Christy Peterson of Indie Craft Experience.
At any given moment, we know what the world is feeling.
Are you wearing pajama pants to school? Why, yes, I am.
I was, in a way, elevating him. I was celebrating him.
We wanted to build a beer pong table.
No, it's the Show ATL podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Show ATL podcast. Today, my lovely guests are Shannon Green and Christy Peterson from Indie Craft Experience right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So awesome having you guys here. Quick context. I got introduced to Shannon via Yukai Lin. However, I have been a vendor at your Indie Craft markets in the past through my lamp company, Old Fourth Ward Light Co., which is a tiny little venture, but you guys have been so cool to give me an opportunity to take this untested product that I've made and showcase it to the Atlanta community, which has been tremendous, just getting to meet people and getting to be a part of that environment. So for anyone listening, if you haven't been to an Indie Craft Experience market, there are 5 throughout the year, spring, summer, fall, winter, or holiday, and then the holiday shopping spectacular. So
yes,
plenty of opportunities to go, but we're going to go way beyond that today, because you guys are doing so much more than just markets and have been doing so much over the last several years. So I rambled a little bit there, but you guys were, as we were coming up the stairs, you were talking about just being involved in a camp that you guys did back at your studio in Candler Park.
Yes.
So before we get the full backstory, tell me, what is Indie Craft Experience right now? It's so many things, but what is it in a nutshell, if you had to give the elevator pitch for your company and your brand?
I think our mission is to give artists an opportunity to get their products out in front of an audience, like you mentioned, and then also to spread our love of art and craft. So, like camp is a great way to introduce, you know, younger kids and get them on the path of becoming artists. And we're just trying to, you know, give people an opportunity to have a hands-on experience with art or and craft.
So you have a studio here in Candler Park.
Yes.
And I imagine while many things happen at the studio, the reach of indie craft goes far beyond that, right? So you guys are, we're going to talk about how you've been traveling recently with some retreats and expanding kind of what the experiential nature of arts and crafts is in Atlanta. But before we get into that, I kind of want to give both of you a chance to tell your individual stories of how you got into or why you're interested in craft and vintage and arts in the first place. So, I mean, whoever wants to start, but how did you guys get into the craft world personally?
Sure. So I studied painting and psychology in school and always loved making things. And so it was around 2004 that I started just playing around with my sewing machine. And I started upcycling and making clothing. And I found a market at the Youngblood Gallery in 2004. They did a free monthly market. And I set my clothes up and I was selling things. And in October, Christy was set up across from me. And that's how I met Christy. So we became fast friends. We traded items at the end of the night. And later that year, in November, I did my first large craft show in Austin, Texas. It was called Stitch,
okay.
And it was a fashion show and a craft market.
Okay.
And I was super excited about that. And Christy had heard of the Renegade Craft Festival in Chicago, and we thought that Atlanta needed a craft festival. So we started planning in January of 2005.
Okay, so met in 04 or 05?
04.
Okay, met in 04 at Craftwork.
Yes.
And this was in Grant Park?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And you had just been making clothing for about a year at that point?
Probably about less than a year.
Okay.
Yeah, I started that summer. So the summer of 04, I started making clothing. We organized a local fashion show, and my looks were in the AJC.
Really?
And after that, yeah.
That's encouraging.
It was.
What a way to start doing that, you know, what an encouraging sign.
Definitely.
So you must have been very, very talented.
You know, I did something right.
What were the clothes, if you don't mind me asking?
Was I did a bunch of different things. I would use vintage textiles and upcycle them into skirts. And I would do appliques on shirts. And I did a bunch of slip dresses that were hand-dyed.
Okay.
And I started doing the market circuit in Atlanta.
Very cool.
So the neighborhood festivals.
Very cool. So how was the first show, the first Craftwork experience? Was it, obviously you caught the market bug, but was it the environment of the place, or was it just your personal experience getting to sell clothing?
I think it was the environment. I think it was being around other people that were crafters and makers and the community, you know, because a lot of times when you're making something, you're at home in your studio, or I was at home in my home studio, or otherwise known as my dining room, which I took over. And you're kind of isolated. So it's so exciting to be able to meet other makers and share what you've been doing and get feedback.
Yeah, that is encouraging. I mean, just from personal experience, it's all kind of just for yourself until someone else reaches out and recognizes the value in that. And then it's just so cool to be able to share with someone what you're making, because it becomes personal.
Definitely.
You know? And when someone is receptive to something that you've made, it's just so cool. And so that's awesome, and excited to dive into how that's grown even bigger with indie craft now. But wanted to get to you as well, Christy, on kind of your backstory. Have you been a lifelong crafter, or did you start making clothes in 2004?
I have been a lifelong crafter.
Okay.
Back in the 80s, I always had a friendship bracelet pinned to my jeans so
nice.
I could work on it, you know, at any given moment. I guess when I was younger, I might have considered myself a crafter. And then at some point, maybe crafts that weren't so cool anymore. So I tried to be more of an artist, but then I think at some point I realized maybe that was a little too serious for me. But I did a ton of art in college. I graduated from Agnes Scott in 99 and did tons of printmaking while I was there, which was, the print shop there is amazing, and that was a really awesome opportunity. Spent many nights there because I was a procrastinator and couldn't plan my projects very well, so I would spend a lot of all-nighters. And then I guess when I graduated, I wasn't exactly sure how to continue my art practice, because I guess when you're in school, like, you're using all this awesome equipment and you don't necessarily have access to things after you graduate. I think Atlanta's actually done a great job in general. Like, there's a lot more opportunity now to, to have access to different types of equipment, like through Atlanta Printmaker Studio or, but at the time I'm like, well, I guess I'm done with printmaking because I don't have a giant printing press to work on.
Yeah, so, that would be a challenge.
Yeah. So I think it took me a couple of years to kind of figure out things I could do at home. I got really interested in jewelry and I took classes at Chastain and Callenwald, like silver smithing jewelry classes. And I think for me, a big turning point, I'm from Atlanta and I've lived here forever, but I moved away very briefly just for a few months with my husband to his hometown in Paducah, Kentucky.
Okay.
Which is, compared to Atlanta, a very, very small place.
Right.
But they have a really great artist community. And we moved there in 2003. And just lived there for a few months. We decided it wasn't the best place for us and immediately packed up and came back to Atlanta. But it was cool to see the artist community that was developing there. And when I got back to Atlanta, actually backing up, while I was there, since I didn't really know very many people, I spent a lot of more time than normal on the internet. And I discovered a community called Glitter, which was on a website called getcrafty.com. And this was where I feel that I found my people, because it was like, it was a forum of probably 99% women from all over the country that were kind of in the same exact spot as me, like starting to get really into crafting, maybe considering starting a business and just like sharing ideas with one another. And that's where I first heard about the Renegade Craft Fair and got really inspired by what they were doing in Chicago. Made a lot of friends online that I'm still friends with, like 15 years later.
That's awesome.
And some of them I still have not met in real life yet, but I'm sure that I will someday. But then when I moved back to Atlanta, I just felt like I was much more knowledgeable about this whole indie craft scene that was taking place all over the country. And I felt really motivated and wanted to do something for my hometown of Atlanta. And things just kind of fell into place that I heard about Youngblood and got involved with the community there. The original owners, Maggie and Kelly, did a really great job at fostering a community there, which was really awesome. And then met Shannon, and then it all started to come together.
That's awesome. So different journeys leading to the same place. You clearly both kind of fell in love with something and met each other at a really important time in both of y'all's lives when you were hungry to take that passion for a thing into something bigger.
Yes.
Before we continue on, just so I don't put my foot in my mouth going forward, the term arts and crafts, because indie craft is arts, crafts, vintage. It's a lot of hands-on and experiential now as well, which we'll get into. But arts and crafts, what is the difference between art and craft? Is there one? What is the right language or nomenclature that people who are makers and creators use? I mean, what should I be using when I talk to people who are making things for a living?
I think arts and crafts is a fine phrase to use. I think we've always kind of said indie craft just to differentiate the aesthetic. Like, there's lots of craft markets, especially in Atlanta. Like, we have a lot of really amazing neighborhood festivals with great craft markets. But especially, the difference is maybe not so clear now, but in 2004, 2005, those markets definitely weren't as appealing to me just from a style standpoint.
Okay.
And I think I've always thought of it as like they had a lot of high-end craft.
Okay.
With like
this is the, these are the quote unquote art and craft markets or
yeah,
just these little neighborhood festivals.
Yeah, like more high-end craft and then also I guess what I would call like kind of country crafts. It's all about the style or aesthetics.
Now is this like recycled like metals turned into some sort of lawn decoration? Is that what you mean?
Not in 2004. It was more like, you know, a $300 really well-made basket.
Wow, gotcha.
You know, something like that. And what we were doing was a little bit different, a little more affordable, a different aesthetic, pop culture references, that kind of thing.
Got it.
But those markets since, you know, in the past 15 years, like if I had applied at that time, they probably wouldn't have accepted me. Like I didn't fit their look,
gotcha.
But they've all, you know, changed and evolved a lot these days, over time. So a lot of our vendors do those markets as well as ours, and they fit, you know, both nicely.
And I would say our vendors describe themselves as artists, as designers, as makers, as crafters. So
right.
It's kind of an individual distinction that people make.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. I've always tried to be somewhat sensitive to the extent that I'm able to be politically correct about, you know, respecting people's craft, because I understand now in doing my own craft work, you know, that it's it takes a lot out of you in terms of, you know, justifying your use of time if it's not your full-time thing, right? It's like,
yeah.
Why am I doing this? It's because I feel good about what I'm making.
Yeah.
How can I take this one step further? Am I putting too much into this? Am I putting too little into this? And it's nice to be validated somewhat, you know, in that environment. So been trying to be more sensitive to that, but okay, thank you for that education. I appreciate it, because it's not a world that I'm very familiar with, at least not until I started, you know, coming to indie craft experiences, mm-hmm. and to the markets and being a vendor, and I see the behind the scenes, how hard people work,
yeah.
mm-hmm. to set up, to present what they've made, and then all to just tear it down at the end of the day, you know? I mean,
yeah.
it's a lot
yeah.
of hard work that goes into this. And, you know, trying to just be sensitive to that. But what was it, going back to the 2004 Kraftwerk experience, about, I guess, the exchange? Because you mentioned that you had made a trade, mm-hmm. and then it kept in touch going forward. So what was it about that moment with each other, as well as the market itself, that made you guys start thinking and getting the wheels turning about this might be something that we want to do?
I think for me, like I said, I had made a lot of friends online, but not so many in real life that were doing the same thing. I had like a few months prior to that organized a small craft market at Sweet Melissa's in Decatur.
Yes,
which is still
I love that
around.
Place. Yeah.
So some of the friends I had made online, like some of the local Atlanta crafters, we got together and made just a small holiday market. I think we probably had like 10 or 12 vendors.
Okay.
But I, you know, you meet people and for whatever reason you become closer, you don't, you know, and I do have one friend from that group that I still consider a good friend, but I don't know. I just meeting Shannon, like yeah. we just became fast friends for whatever reason.
And I love that. You both have very bright personalities. So
thank
I understand
you.
where the connection is.
We also, I think one of our superpowers is we always are full of ideas. Sometimes our husbands,
detriments.
Yes, they'll roll their eyes at us because we'll say we have a new idea and they're like, oh no.
Oh, God.
Because usually if we're really into the idea, we'll make it happen. And we didn't know that about each other in 2004, but it's something that we've carried with us for 15 years.
That's a rare trait in a creative mind. Because the
yes.
creative mind, by nature, is always generating new things, but
mm-hmm.
so few of those things get filtered into action. Just because, you know, what is infinite in our minds becomes very finite in production with time, resources, money, whatever. So, I mean, it's a huge testament to the balance that you guys have in your productivity and work ethic, as well as your creativity and being able to produce all this. But IndieCraft is now going on its 15th year.
Yes.
So officially founded in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So just 1 year after you guys met.
Actually, we met in October. and started planning in January.
Wow. Okay. So
we basically met in October at Craftwork.
Okay.
We, a couple of weeks later, ran into each other at Sevenanda in Little Five Points.
Yes. Okay. Shopping.
And then we did Chomp and Stomp as vendors in Cabbage Town, and we set up next to each other. So we spent the day together.
I love it. I love Chomp
and
Stomp.
And that was it. I think by January, that was October. And then in January, we started planning, officially planning.
So very quick turnaround time.
Mm-hmm.
What I guess the planning to the first event is what I'm really curious to dig into, because it's so relevant to so much that I've been working on over the last year and a half with this and with other ideas and trying to make ideas manifest into, mm-hmm. into things. But what was, you know, you decided that you're going to do something in January. When was the first event? What was, you know, how did it go? What was that journey like for you guys?
It was a 6-month journey. So we met up in January and came up with a name. So we knew that we needed a name, a logo, a space.
A website.
Maybe a little bit of money to get started. And so we gave ourselves 6 months.
Okay. All right. So you knew that you needed, whatever it was, you needed to make it happen in six
mm-hmm.
months. Okay. And was IndieCraft the very first name that you settled on?
Yeah, we came up with that name on the patio at Elmire.
Amazing.
We had a third business partner at the time, mm-hmm. and a couple of years later, she ended up moving to Brooklyn to go to grad school.
Okay.
But Susan was our third person, and yeah, we sat down, came up with the name.
All good naming sessions are done over some good food and good drink.
Yeah, absolutely.
We came up with Shirley Teal, and with that logo, having Sangria at Sister Louise's in Edgewood.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, all the best things that last, I think, are done over food and drink. But so 6 months, and you knew pretty much out the gate that you wanted to in some sense replicate whatever it was that drew you both first to markets in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So decided to do a craft market, I imagine.
Craft market and a fashion show.
Okay.
And for that one, it was actually an evening event. So we were kind of mirroring what Shannon had experienced in Austin at Stitch. So it was more of a nighttime. It had a little more of a party atmosphere to it.
Gotcha.
We had live bands, a fashion show, the market. And it was at iDrum when they were still on MLK.
Okay. Yep.
In the north. I guess that's Grant Park there, or whatever that little corner is called. I had spent a lot of time at iDrum because my husband's a musician. So
gotcha.
I
okay.
spent a lot of time there seeing bands play. And then Susan was involved, which I think she was a board
on
member
the board
mm-hmm. at iDrum.
Okay.
So
okay.
that was how we decided to use that space.
And how did it go?
It went really well. It was more than we expected. So
okay.
we're known for our swag bags. We give away these swag bags. And so we had these tote bags, and this little company called Etsy was starting up.
Wow. All right.
And they offered to hand screen print four color logo onto our first tote bag.
That's awesome.
So,
okay.
So they got involved.
They launched the next day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Yes.
So you guys are just a little bit older than Etsy.
Yes. One okay. day.
One day older.
Yeah. So I had met Rob, the founder, on Get Crafty, the website I mentioned earlier.
Got it. Okay.
And so I had, you know, corresponded with him, I guess maybe for like a year. And I guess when he heard we were doing an event, I think, I don't know whose idea it was to do swag bags, but he said they wanted to print them. So that was
cool. That is. It's not something that, I mean, I'm definitely not well known about y'all's journey, but that's just interesting that you were able to work with Etsy at a very young age when you guys were just starting out as well, and just seeing where y'all's companies have gone. Etsy, obviously, much more digital, but fairly large brand, but still, I mean, very cool. And you've been doing the swag bags ever since.
We have, yes.
Every market.
Yes. Every single one.
So what do people... I've never attended as a guest, only mm-hmm. a vendor. So what do people get in a swag bag?
So the bags, for the First few years, the bags were kind of simple, just with like our logo and the dates of the event. And then probably 9 years ago ish, we started working with artists. So we hire, on our 2 day shows, the bags are different per day. And then, so we hire an artist per bag to come up with the design. And which is a lot of fun. Sometimes it's a local person and they're a vendor. And then sometimes we hire artists that we like from other cities, like Ryan Berkeley from Portland. He's at Berkeley Illustration. He's done, I think, a couple of bags for us. But so the bag itself, we've always done 100% cotton so that they are reusable. They're not that poly whatever stuff that you can't wash. And inside the bag, we encourage all the vendors to send things to promote their business. So we tell them they can do, you know, just business cards, or they can do a few product samples. So sometimes a bag will have actual product samples in it.
Very cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So this was not something that, because I want to talk about how you've learned and grown from day one. This was not something that was something that you've learned and implemented over time. This was right out the gate you were doing this.
The swag bags.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. From the beginning.
So what you said that the first one was more than you expected. The first event was more than you expected. So how did you shift and move from there?
It was more than we expected in several ways. that morning, I remember saying, like, wouldn't it be cool if 100 people came to our event? And then 800 showed up. By more, we also mean, like, everyone involved cried at some point that evening. It was, like, the most stressful thing we have ever done. The iDrum air conditioning could not handle that many people, so we also refer to it as, like, the hottest night of our lives. It was sweltering inside, just, like, awful. At one point, we ran out of, like, cash to make change at the door. So I like ran to Publix to see if anyone on a Saturday night would like give me change. Someone's car got blocked in and they were threatening to call the police if they couldn't figure out how to get their car out. And they wanted people to like help them pick up the car. Like if we can just get like 10 people to pick up the car and move it, like crazy, crazy things.
All things you deal with on the first round of whatever.
Yes, of course.
And we just like didn't know necessarily.
We didn't know what we were getting into.
Yeah. But we're good problem solvers.
Clearly.
And, you know, despite the tears, we are able to like stay calm enough to like figure out how to make things happen.
But that is where either business partnerships are forged or they're broken. And clearly it was forged and made stronger in that situation. Because, you know, me and my partner with Show ATL, Corrigan, our first anything that we did with Show ATL was this warehouse party where we had art up on the walls and we had a few local DJs and bands come play. And we pretty much inherited this old, broken down industrial space in West Midtown. Got a super, super cheap 1 month lease on it. Only in exchange for us bringing it back up to code in terms of health and safety and to getting it cleaned up. And so we pretty much lived in this old warehouse for a month. We did everything ourselves. Like we built, you know, a partition wall. We changed everything out with plumbing in the bathrooms. We built all of the staging and light equipment for the, you know, the music and the entertainment. It was just... it was so much, and we were so invested in this first thing going well, you know, that I think that really kind of forged our partnership, you know, and it is very stressful.
Yeah.
we had lost track of time on the night of the event, and turns out a bunch of people had decided to come, and the band called us, and because we had been setting up all day, literally 6 a.m. we get in there. And there's light and sound and art and whatever people in there working and painting and setting up and doing sound check. And then we had gone home to shower and change because we realized we're still in these nasty clothes and it was a New Year's Eve party. And so we need to dress up a little bit. And on our way back, we're getting texts and calls from the band saying, you know, we're outside, it's freezing and the door is locked. And there's people lining up to like get in and there's no one here. So yeah, so we show up to our own event that we've been working so hard on to unlock the door for everyone, and then proceed to kind of set up while guests are coming in to get things flowing. And it was stressful. Some tears, some moments in a private closet, kind of crying into my hands. Yeah. But it was well worth it. And here we are today. But did you guys, moving from what was in all cases both a very successful and a fairly stressful event, did you say, okay, we're ready for another one? Or was there a pause after the first event saying, well, maybe this is really not what we want to do?
No, I think we were like, wow, 800 people came. We have to keep going with this. Like,
there's a need for this.
So yeah. We just started working on we decided to do a holiday market as our next thing. And yeah, just got started on it. I just remember thinking back, the next morning we were cleaning up, and I had to go straight to a friend's wedding. Like, basically, like, didn't have time to shower, like, just had to put, like, a nice dress onto my, like, awful sweaty body and go straight to the wedding. And
been there.
Like, yeah.
Definitely been there. How long after the first one was the second one?
We did a holiday show.
Okay.
Like December.
Mm-hmm, okay. December. So we did that at iDrum. So we had received some press from Creative Loafing, like a really nice story.
Nice.
Before our first event. We had a lot of followers on our MySpace page. Very 2005.
That was the most trendy thing in 2005. Yes. So congratulations. 2005 me is jealous of all your MySpace followers.
Arlan designed our logo, so that was really exciting too.
Yeah.
So I feel like we had this package. Like, we built a lot in the first 6 months, had that successful show, and so yeah, we were like, what's next?
Nice. Okay. Yeah. So
we were super lucky with the Creative Living article. And Felicia Feaster, who's still a writer here in Atlanta, somehow, I guess maybe through Youngblood, found out about us. And we were like the cover story, which I think made the event what
it was. It's hard to get really good and visible press in Creative Loafing, because in the environment that we're in today,
it's a different publication than it was previously.
100%. Yeah. 100%. But now, looking at it now, you're dealing with a magazine that is somewhat struggling to keep, or a publication generally that's somewhat struggling to keep its native, you know, cultural Atlanta identity amidst a massive transformation and gentrification effort and commercialization effort, where it still needs to provide a service, but where does it fit into the puzzle that is now Atlanta? You know, it's why I say now it's hard to get a good review or publication or something posted in Creative Loafing, because I feel like Creative Loafing is now struggling to keep up with everything that's happening. And even if they come to you, they've come to a couple of our events, we've never been featured in anything, you know, so you really have to kind of knock it out of the park to get a really, you know, visible, nice publication and Creative Loafing. But I respect the hell out of that publication even today, but I understand the challenges of staying relevant to a subculture of a community when that subculture is eroding, you know, like the real ethos of like what Atlanta was 15 years ago is changing a lot. You know, and a lot of the neighborhoods are just being completely transformed culturally, really? You know, so not just financially, but the fabric of who used to live there and who lives there now, totally different. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, look at where we are right now in Old Fourth Ward, Inman Park. It's 10 years ago, unrecognizable to what it is today, you know, so kudos to being able to evolve with, I guess, the city, being able to evolve with Atlanta, because you're still going strong. I mean, it's stronger than ever before. So
thank you.
15 years later. So that's, you know, props to both of you.
Thank you.
That's something I have to remind myself about, though, is, I kind of forget. I'm like, we've been around for 15 years. Like, how is it possible that there are artists that are just discovering us? And then I'm like, I have to remind myself, there's a lot of people that are new to Atlanta and, you know, haven't necessarily seen our 15-year journey or whatever, but it's crazy how different the city is, but then also exciting that there's, you know, so many new people here.
And also we get people that write on their application, I've been coming to your show since I was a kid, and this is my new line. Yes.
And then I feel really old, but proud.
Yeah. Feel proud that you built something that has lasted and, you know, this long and done so well. I think it's just so, you know, so cool. But 15 years, what has changed? I mean, let's just talk about the markets, right, before we get into all of the new things that have come from IndieCraft as a company. But what in 2005, what effort went into setting up for planning, creating one of these markets versus now? Has anything changed? What have you learned? And I guess generally, can you walk us through without, you know, spilling any proprietary knowledge? What goes into a typical IndieCraft experience market?
I think one of the biggest things we learned that very first night, I'm just like even embarrassed to say this, we did not mark off the booth spaces for our first event. We just thought everyone would come and like set up their table and, you know, would just take their amount of space that they were supposed to. And boy, were we wrong. Some people had these giant booths. They took up like as much space as they could. And then we ran out of space and didn't have enough for everyone, and had to get people to move. So, I mean, a lot of planning goes into it. We now spend a lot of time planning where each booth is going to go. We ask on the application, do you have specific needs? Is there a friend you want to be next to? Do you need electricity? Our application, you know, back then was on paper.
Nice.
You could mail it in.
Mail.
Nice. Okay.
So now we have like a real system online.
Yeah.
And a lot of time goes into, you know, placing people. We try not to put similar products together. Mm-hmm. And just so it's a fully curated experience. So as an attendee, when you're walking through, we want it to, you know, it's the vendors that have been selected as well as, you know, the path that you're walking through,
right,
seeing all the different things. What else?
So many things. So many things.
I mean, you know, the word experience is in the name of your company. So what experience are you trying to elicit when you are setting up for these events, and how do you go about, is it mostly about the vendors and the products that come in, or is it mostly about, how they're positioned and what space and other amenities you guys provide and create?
I think we've always wanted it to feel fun, and particularly we want, when people are doing their holiday shopping, we want them to come shop with us and have a fun day rather than, you know, trudging off to the mall, like, gotta get these people checked off our list. We want it to be a fun, you know, day with their friends where they can spend, you know, as much time as they want, and they're finding these unique things from, and they get to talk to the person that made it, which is so special. And a lot of the people are local, so they might see them again. And then we also have a lot of vendors that come from all over the countries.
Okay.
So we wanted to feel just like, you know, not only did you buy a gift for your friend, but you also got to meet this artist and maybe hear their story. And you get to touch the item before you buy it.
It is very hands-on. I mean, you are right there with the person who created the good, and you get to talk about it, touch it, you know, ask questions, which is different than, you know, in most cases when you have so many different types of products in one place, you don't really get that. But, yeah.
And I would say early on, Christy and I were traveling and selling our items at different craft markets. So we did craft markets in San Diego, Chicago, Austin, Brooklyn, Washington, D.C. And Portland. We were in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And we were meeting other crafters. And so we would invite those crafters to come to Atlanta and participate in our show. And some of those crafters still come to Atlanta. So I think that's been really great to expand their audience to the Atlanta area. And we also get attendees from around the Southeast, people that drive in from Alabama and Tennessee,
really?
South Carolina, cool, to come to the show and shop. So,
I love that. Okay.
And I think it's cool, too. We get a great blend of repeat vendors as well as new people, mm-hmm. Every single show. So there, we have a vendor, Vixen Sullivan, that lives in Mississippi, and he's been doing every single show that we do, I think, for the past like 4 years. So he has repeat customers that come to seek him out to buy the new thing that he's created.
That's very cool.
And then one of our local vintage vendors, Michelle from a Vintage Affair, she was telling me at the last show that when she's shopping for her inventory, she has specific customers in mind.
Oh, wow.
So okay. She knows the style of, you know, our frequent shoppers, right, and what they're going to be interested in. And I thought that was so cool, just like that would happen over time, that we have shoppers that come back and vendors that come back, but then there's always fresh new stuff as well at each event.
Yeah. And it's a testament to the brand that you've built, that you don't have to be there to make it work. I mean, you have created an environment where people can build their own brands, you know, in your market, and have these repeat customers, and create an environment that is conducive to guests coming in from out of town and repeat guests. And I mean, that's hard to achieve, you know, to just completely be able to remove yourself from the picture. And then this operation still is what it is. I mean, I don't know how many people are coming just to see Shannon and Christy. I imagine several, right? But when you're talking about, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of people going through a space, you know, it's just all those people are there because they love the experience of being there. So, so well done there. But with the vendor specifically, is there what are like the firm parameters of, because there is a lot of selection involved, and I'm not going to go into the details of, you know, why this person over this person or this product over that product, but what are the firm parameters that are, you know, that you set to say, well, you know, we absolutely don't take blank, right? So what are you not going to find at an indie craft experience market?
Mass produced items.
Okay.
that's the main one. I mean, we do get people that apply that have their items made overseas. They've designed them, they have them produced, but the problem with that is they can offer them at such a low price point.
Right.
And so it's not fair to the other vendors.
Yeah.
You know, so everything has to be handcrafted. And then really, you know, it's a new crop of vendors that apply for each market.
Got it.
So we're looking for things that are unusual, things that are different. We're looking at people's social media following. We're looking at websites.
So it's very still, you know, very much so a labor of love and you two pouring into that selection process, right?
Yes.
I imagine it's still just you two who yes. filter through
mm-hmm.
this. Okay.
Yeah. Us and 8 hours of time or so. Okay. Plus or minus.
That's not terrible. You know, I imagine, you know, a whole weekend dedicated to this, but so, you know, last question about these markets, and because there's so much to talk about beyond that, but the Holiday Spectacular, for people who are listening and don't know what the Holiday Shopping Spectacular is, it's in November of every year, right? Like third weekend or second weekend of November generally?
It's always the weekend before Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So this year I think it's the November 23rd and 24th.
Okay.
And we kind of look at it as, you know, you're kicking off your holiday season, and if you're lucky and diligent, you could get 95% of your holiday shopping done.
It is
at that market.
It is pretty spectacular, as the name boasts. I mean, I did the one last year at Georgia Freight Depot, and mm-hmm. this year it's going to be at the Georgia World Congress Center.
It
right?
Is. Yes.
Was I supposed to say that?
Yeah.
Yes. Sure.
This is brand new information.
Okay.
We're really excited. We're gonna have a lot of space, so we're going to be able to offer vendors a larger booth if they're interested,
so
or
cool.
they can do, you know, the same size that we've done previously.
Right.
And yeah, we're really excited to be, you know, right downtown, somewhere that's so accessible, right on the MARTA line, tons of parking. So,
I love it. I'm excited. I will be applying, just giving
awesome.
You a heads up. So congratulations on that. But has that always, was the goal for that to be the big event of the year? Because it is, you know, I don't want to say it's much larger than your other markets, but I mean, it is pretty
it is.
Big.
It's much larger. It's much, yes.
Our one day events have about 65 vendors,
okay.
and the Holiday Spectacular has 175.
Wow.
We're going to bump it up a tiny bit this year. It might be closer to 200. But we also, we don't want our vendors to feel like they're competing with each other for
right.
attention. So
right.
we'll never have a show that's like 500 vendors or something crazy. Like, we want it to be a manageable. We also don't want shoppers to feel overwhelmed.
Well, sure.
So
yeah.
A manageable amount of space to walk through. And yeah, we're very excited. For this year, it has always been our December holiday show is actually new. We've only done that for 3 years, I think.
Gotcha. Okay.
So the November one has always been like our big holiday push.
Gotcha.
And we've, I guess a few years ago, just felt like it would be fun to do a one day show in December, just as a last minute shopping opportunity.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, it's the first time, I went as a vendor, which was last year. There's typically a line out the door for like about an hour at least, if not longer, before the doors open. So has that and to all your shows, really, there's always a line out the door. But you guys do charge to get in. Has that always been the model? And have you found that works? And why does it work?
We've always charged since the beginning, and I think because it's a private event, and other shopping events that I attended, there's always been a fee to get in. And I think that brings the people that are serious about shopping. So we offer more than just shopping, mm-hmm. but you're going to shop. You're going to this curated marketplace. And yeah, for our holiday show, I think this past year our line was 3 hours long. So we did not... It was pretty intense.
Yeah. But you just can't do anything about that at that point, right? I mean, with the space restrictions and just your constraints, that's kind of just what it is. And you know, well done on the attendance, right?
Thank you. Yeah, we did some on-the-spot problem solving to make the line move faster.
Okay, there you go. But that is, I mean, you were both very just incredibly creative and productive people. So on that note, Let's move beyond the markets, because there's so much more. High Museum First Fridays, no longer doing that, but something that you guys were both getting involved in with IndieCraft in terms of working for free at the High Museum? Or how did this work?
they contracted with us, and okay. it ties back to our desire to spread the love. So
yeah.
We provided a hands-on activity. Because we feel like everyone should do hands-on
yeah.
art. And we would work with a local artist to come up with the project. And so it would kind of highlight the local artists. And it would be something that attendees could do.
Yeah, okay.
And either, you know, they could spend... It was a simple enough project. They could spend just like 10 minutes on it. Or they could really sit down and like go deep on it.
Yeah, okay. But so that was one foray into something... Outside of markets and outside of things in your studio, but you've mentioned in the questionnaire, which I thank you again for filling that out. It really does help me focus on diversifying the business through mm-hmm. more experiential, more hands-on cultural things, events, mm-hmm. retreats. So what does that look like? Because I know this year you've done two retreats. Right? Or
we
three?
Have two coming up.
Two coming up, and you've done one to Morocco? Is that right?
I led one to Morocco this
okay.
year that wasn't directly affiliated with IndieCraft.
Got it. Okay, my bad. I got
That's okay.
that confused. But tell me about what the retreats mean, what they are, and why you decided this was a good business strategy for IndieCraft.
I think over the last couple of years, Christy and I have gotten back to making things. So, you know, we started our company because we love to make things. We were crafters. We wanted an opportunity to sell what we make.
Mm-hmm.
And as we grew larger, we stopped making things because there was no time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really funny. We used to craft things and sell them in other states.
Okay.
But we didn't have time or capacity to sell at our own shows in Atlanta. And then we just reached this point where we just didn't even have the capacity to sell at other shows.
Gotcha.
So for the past, I would say, three and a half years, we've been starting to take time out, studio time for ourselves to get back to making. And we just realize how important that is. And we also love to travel.
Yeah.
So it goes hand in hand. It's like providing time and space for people to have a really cool experience in a different location and to make things.
So what, can you give me an example of what the itinerary for one of these trips might look like and why you decided on that structure?
We're about to go on our Oregon retreat, which is in a couple of weeks. And we did this one last year as well. So we're really excited to return. A friend of ours owns an inn in Seaside, Oregon. So it's right on the coast. It's called the Starry Night Inn. And she bought it with a friend, I think like a year and a half ago, and was posting. We had been starting to think about doing retreats. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, she was posting the amazing renovation that they did with this space. So we're like, let's go try it there. So we're doing a whole weekend of indigo dyeing, which is something that we're both really into, as well as other natural dyes.
Okay.
And it's part making and then part kind of relaxing, like just building in time for yourself. So the inn itself is super cute. It has art everywhere and it's just a really nice place to relax. It's just a couple of blocks from the beach. So it's a great, you know, you can go walk along the beach whenever you feel like it. And we had a great experience last year with people produced actually kind of a large body of work while they were there.
Okay.
So it's both relaxing and making and also, you know, making new friends and just having a nice time. So.
How instruction heavy is it? Is it more of like a meditative experience where you are creating for the sake of some sort of exercise and finding peace and joy in doing something? Or is it more of a, I'm going to learn this thing?
It's both, but more maybe that I'm going to learn this thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of chemistry involved in an indigo vat. So we want people to walk away with that knowledge.
Got it. Okay. And is that, and why dying? Because you mentioned that you were both getting into this yourselves over the last several years, studying and experimenting with and traveling for learning how to dye, natural dye. So why that? Why is that? Why should people learn how to do that? And you know, how is it different from a, you know, an industrial textile dye or anything like that?
So I've always been interested in color, and of course my background is in textiles, so mm-hmm. I made clothes for many years, and I used those industrial dyes and achieved really beautiful, brilliant colors. But I think there's a magic in taking a leaf or a flower and extracting color from it. And there's also kind of a wild card aspect that it really depends on the environment in which the plant was grown.
Mm-hmm.
Christy's been working a lot with avocado recently.
Okay.
And, you know, it really depends. You're not going to get the same result twice.
Got it.
And there's something really interesting and intriguing about that.
And I think also just, you know, we want to be cognizant about our environment. So the chemical dyes are just awful. And it, you know, it is so cool that that's not the only option. You can learn how to extract color from plants and vegetables and flowers. And we were really lucky last year. We got to go to a small town outside Oaxaca, Mexico, mm-hmm. and study with a family there the town itself, everyone there is a weaver. And I guess I need to get clear on the facts, but I guess like in the 60s, they started using the chemical dyes and they like very quickly saw the adverse environmental effect on their town. And so they're trying to preserve the old ways, this family that we stayed with, so that, you know, and they love teaching other people about it.
That's very cool.
The person that we learned from, her name is Juana, and she's amazing. And she basically, like, from her parents and the tradition was, you know, probably learned how to make 10 different colors just as a child. But she's like taken it so far beyond and can make like 200 shades now just from using natural things in her area. And I think that's pretty amazing.
It is very amazing. On the environmental note, which is what I was curious about, how obviously in, you know, mass industrial chemical manufacturing is not good for the environment.
Right.
Right. But it is a reality that is resulted from the mass demand for clothing and textiles, right? Mm-hmm. So how sustainable really is natural dyeing? I mean, if you were to say that, okay, chemical dyes, industrial manufacturing of chemical dyes, bad for the planet. Okay, let's replace all of that demand from the supply side with natural dyeing. Is that an option? Is natural dyeing ever going to be something that goes beyond a very small, hyper-local effort?
I don't really know, but I think if you look holistically at slow fashion in general, I don't know if natural dyes will ever, you know, replace chemical dyes. But if you look at all the different aspects of, like, you can buy so many clothes at the thrift store that mm-hmm. are in perfect condition, and why did someone even bother getting rid of them in the first place? And, you know, sewing stuff from scratch, and there's so many ways to avoid, you know, buying the mass-produced clothing that comes, you know, from a structure that's not healthy for our planet and the people involved in making them. There are options, but it obviously would take a major overhaul for slow fashion to be the norm.
And I like to think too, I mean, Levi Strauss started with indigo. Like his original jeans were dyed with indigo before.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So there's still ways that we could tweak things.
Of course. What I love about Indie Craft Experience is that it is bringing people back to the idea of, like you mentioned, slow fashion, creating things, what it actually takes to make something from start to finish, which we've become, you know, in our consumer culture, very desensitized to where things come from,
yes,
right?
Very.
We are so far down the supply chain mm-hmm. of where food, clothing, entertainment, fuel comes from, that to step back and actually be involved in making something, I imagine for a lot of people, it's a first time experience. Do you work with a lot of people who they're like, I've never done this before. I've never made anything with my hands. I've never been a quote unquote crafty person. And you know, and now I love it, or I've taken something away from it. Or do you find mostly that your clientele is people who are lifelong crafters, or is it both?
Both. But we also, like, we teach workshops at our studio a lot, and I, you know, definitely people come and take a class from us and they're like, I haven't made anything since I, you know, high school art class or whatever. And they, you know, are amazed that they could actually sit down and create something.
But I
think you're totally right. Just like how desensitized our culture is in terms of where things come from. And that's something, you know, the natural dye stuff is kind of new for us within the past few years, but from day one, that's something we've been trying to promote in terms of handcrafted, that, like, your stuff doesn't have to have, like, a million, like, middlemen between where it was created and when it finally got to your house. You
right.
can buy something directly from someone who labored over it and used their skills and talent to create something.
I think a lot of people also forget that you can wear an item of clothing for more than one season or more than one
yes.
year.
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes. I recently did, like, an inventory of my closet.
Yep.
And I'm at kind of a halfway point of half of it is either handcrafted or I bought it used from the thrift store or a vintage vendor, which I feel pretty great about. And then, but there's this other category of there are things I bought from Target or Macy's or whatever, but I've actually owned them for 8 years
right.
or 9 years, and I'm still wearing them. And so I think that's, super important. You can, you know, wear things for a long time before they, like, give out on you.
You can. I mean, to your point, I've owned things that I've been wearing for years and years and years, and they still fit. They're still of good quality. I take care of them. Mm-hmm. And I find so often there's just so much to consume.
Mm-hmm.
In our society, you know, in any developed society, in a country where 70% of the GDP comes from consumer spending,
yeah,
and so much of that goes on, you know, non-durable items like clothing or food or whatever, it's just so much. It's so damn much. But you can put together a well-coiffed wardrobe year after year after year by applying a little bit of creativity to things that you already own, mm-hmm. right? Generally speaking, right? There's maybe you don't have a trench coat. You got to buy that, right? But other than that, other than, you know, niche products, generally, I think you don't need a new t-shirt or button down every 6 months, which is what we've been fed through our culture and through media and through everything our whole lives, is that you need blank because this old thing is no longer relevant or is no longer going to achieve the same end. So, I mean, I think it's wonderful that, I mean, in the process of making, you appreciate more, right? I mean, in the process of creating something, you are more reluctant to see that as a commodity and as disposable, right? Because you have invested into it. But what else is being made in the studio? Getting back to making, right? So not just dying, but what is an example of a workshop that I could come take at the studio right now? Well, not right this second, but generally right now.
We developed a roster of workshops last fall to offer people, and we did about 2 months of workshops where you could come and drop in and just make something. So we had this menu of things that you could craft. So we had leather goods, we had metal stamp jewelry. You could come and make a bath bomb that looks like a geode. So just a lot of fun craft opportunities where you could bring a bottle of wine and a couple of friends and make something.
Very cool.
Geared towards holiday gifts.
Okay.
So it was like in November and December.
Got it. So this is not a year-round? The workshop is not open year-round?
We also have... So we called that DIY experiences, and that was kind of a specific thing for the holiday season, which I'm sure we'll launch again this year. And then we also have workshops. We're developing what we're going to do in the fall. So... because our passion right now is natural dyes, most of them are related to that. But we have one that is, well, we do indigo dyeing with shibori techniques. So shibori is a Japanese technique for creating resists and patterns on fabric.
Okay.
We do one with cochineal, which is a dye that comes from Mexico. Mm-hmm. It's lots of pinks and reds. We did a really awesome one in the spring that was, it was all flowers related. So... there's a technique where you basically pound flowers into the fabric and the color stays on the fabric. And then also bundle dyeing, which is using steam to get the pigment to stay onto the textile.
Got it.
So yeah, we're doing lots of textiles right now.
Okay.
And block printing, mm-hmm. printing with rust. And then I've also been making inks out of natural materials. So we've done a couple of making workshops. Mm-hmm.
So on that note, I read that you guys had recently done an ink workshop in a corporate environment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is that fairly new for you guys, getting into more group corporate kind of things?
Yeah, and it's something we're really excited about because we feel like everyone should do hands-on things. Mm-hmm. I worked in an office for 10 years, and it's hard to sit at your desk all day, you know? it's not even good for your body. Like, you need to be up and moving around. And this is, you know, it allows people to use their creativity. So we're reaching out to corporations to basically hire us to come in to do workshops with their employees.
That's very cool. On that note, I guess, what does the future look like for you guys in terms of, not hyper-specific, but what is... a diversifying of the indie craft experience through experiential, through cultural things. What are ideas that you guys are working on developing now, and how is indie craft going to evolve in the coming year or two? Are you going to do more corporate stuff? Are you going to focus more on stuff in the workshop? Are you going to, you know, stay more or less strictly retreats and markets? I mean, what is shifting, and how is that? And how is the ethos and the mission of the brand shifting, or is it?
I think we, over the past couple of years, have developed several things that are new for us that we're really into. The retreats, for instance. So we have the Oregon one, and then we have one to Oaxaca, Mexico in September that we're really excited about. And then the corporate stuff is kind of brand new this year. Developing our camp even further. We did 3 weeks this summer, and it was so much fun and exhausting. But I think we're like kind of hitting on like lots of different age groups,
right,
and, you know, lots of different settings. The markets will always be our core. And we love them so much, but yeah.
More hands-on experiences for sure. So, and that came out of offering the workshops at our studio. Small companies and a couple of corporations started reaching out and asking us to come to them, to come to a holiday party, to do hands-on make and take type activities.
And they also came to us. There were a few that did like a holiday activity at our studio. So they brought a group to the studio to do a workshop.
Okay. How big is the studio? I mean, just, I've never been, so
it's fairly large. I think we probably, our largest group has been about 20 people.
20 people for a workshop, and we've had about 60 for events.
Wow. Okay.
So,
very
cool.
It's a good
size.
How long has the studio been a part of IndieCraft? How long have you had that?
Coming up on 6 years.
Wow, cool. So, okay.
Yeah. For the first few years, we shared it with some other artists' friends. And as their needs shifted and changed, we eventually just decided, like, we just wanted to give it a shot on our own.
Yeah.
And it's allowed us to really explore, like Shannon was saying, I've been exploring dying with avocados a lot lately. And it's like, if we don't have people we're sharing with, I can get messy and be all over the place.
Yeah. I can imagine.
Yeah.
With generally how things are growing for you guys, which is tremendous, how has Atlanta changed in relation to what you are, what your mission is and what your company is? Has Atlanta become better, worse, or generally stayed the same for crafters and makers and people who are making things and producing and selling?
I think it's changed for the better. I think there's more awareness. And I definitely think, I mean, people know who we are. So it's grown our audience. And I think there are more opportunities these days for makers.
What piece of advice, if any, or encouragement would you give somebody who is trying to take a hobby or a craft beyond just that? Or either whether it's improving their skill, learning a new trade, or taking something that they're already doing as a hobby and moving that into something that could produce revenue or could grow for them?
I think just to be patient. That kind of thing doesn't happen overnight. You have to really put a lot of time and effort into it. And if it's something they feel passionately about, they should definitely pursue it. But to like give themselves the grace that it's going to take a little while to be profitable,
right,
and to not get frustrated with the process.
Definitely. To enjoy the journey, because it's all about the process.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And I think, too, like, there are other things along the way through the journey that are so amazing that, like, while you're going through the journey, I know I've made some of my closest friends from doing craft markets and that live all over the country. And, you know, so you have to look at the other benefits of it as well, because it's a really awesome thing to be part of a vibrant community and, you know, to get to meet so many cool people that are doing cool things.
As a consumer who goes into indie craft, goes into a market and is looking around and needs to be convinced to purchase something, what advice would you give to that consumer, or what information or wisdom would you pass along to that consumer about the difference that they're making in that purchase by choosing to buy something at the market versus anywhere else?
I think sometimes people might have a little bit of hesitation about price. Like, they see something, they're like, well, I could buy a t-shirt at Target for whatever it costs, $15. Why is this one $30? Mm. And I think if they can, you know, maybe take the time to understand the process and the effort that goes into it, they're really directly benefiting someone by buying something from them. Like, it's just so direct what they're doing. And, you know, this person has learned and then honed skills and put all this effort and talent into creating their product. And as a consumer, you know, of course you want to be frugal, whatever, but are you, it's like the benefit to the artist is so much bigger than you saving $5, you know. It's like you're directly benefiting someone who's working so hard and is passionate about what they're doing. That's what
I think. I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great wisdom. No, and someone, I've been blessed that the income I get from selling at markets or whatever is not my sole source of income. But for some people, it is a large portion of the income that they rely on, and they're getting it through something that they've put a lot of work into. So just as someone who's on the other side of that, it's not just about making the sale, but it is about look what I have created, and it would mean so much to me if you would take something home with you mm-hmm. and support me in the process. And so it's so much bigger than just, you know, a purely transactional thing. Mm-hmm. So thank you guys for creating something that has had such a good impact on our community for so long and is only growing in its impact. I want to be cognizant of your time. So is there, before we move on to, you know, what's coming up next in the immediate future and where people can find you, anything I missed, anything that you guys want to talk about IndieCraft or about y'all, or did we pretty much cover all the good bits?
I think we covered a lot of it.
Yeah.
Good.
We really just want to like encourage people to try making things, whether it's, you know, just as a one-off fun thing that they do or, you know, actually starting a business. We just love to be like the facilitator to help get them moving in the right direction.
Well, you're both wonderful connectors, even more awesome, wonderful people. So, it's my joy to know both of you and to play a very small role in y'all's story and from the side of doing the podcast as well as the events and being a vendor. So thank you for giving me that opportunity as well.
Thank you.
So moving forward now, it's what, June 27th-ish? This podcast will come out in a few days. What is next for you guys? One question is, where can people find you online and on social media? And the other question, follow-up, is where can people expect to see you guys next, whether that's a market or if there's still spots open for a retreat or a workshop or anything?
Our website is ice-atlanta.com, and then we update Instagram almost every day, and it's ice@iceatlanta. And our next event that's coming up is our fall market, September 8th. It's at the Yarab Temple, which is 400 Ponce de Leon. So it's right in Midtown, free parking. It's super easy. And we will have an event there as well on December 15th. But in between those two is our Big Giants Holiday Shopping Spectacular, which we're so excited about, in November. And that's going to be at the Georgia World Congress Center in Building C. And what else? We'll have
workshops coming up. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I think we're going to have a birthday party. I think we're going to throw ourselves a birthday party.
Nice. We just had this for idea 15. Yesterday. Nice. So, yeah, we're like, we need to have a birthday
Stay
party.
Stay tuned for that.
That'll be at our studio in Candler Park in August or September, probably.
Very cool.
And then the two retreats are coming up. So the Oregon one is about to happen, but if people are interested in our Oaxaca one, that's in September, and we're really excited about this cultural experience that we're going to be hosting.
And they can find, so vendors for the markets, as well as people who want to sign up for workshops or retreats, they can find all that on your website.
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Yep. Yeah. Well, Shannon and Christy, IndieCraft Experience, congratulations on 15 years of making a really good impact and just creating something beautiful in our city. Thank you for taking the time to come here today and chat with me. It's been my honor, and hope to keep in touch, and thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Show ATL Podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta creatives and creators and tell the stories of the people and organizations making amazing things in our city.
I am your host, Parsa Vanamory. Our show today was produced by Mr. Coleman Erkins with help from myself and Corrigan Nolan. Our music is produced by Relax with Alex. I want to thank all of the guests who come onto this program and tell their amazing stories with us and share with us, as well as to our wonderful listeners who continue to support us week in and week out. If you love this episode, if you love this show as a whole, if you like Show ATL and consider it something that you listen to frequently, please consider giving us a 5-star rating or a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever else you use to listen to your podcasts. Please consider supporting us if you care to. Again, we're a small team working to put together this show for you every week. And we have a Patreon page, www.patreon.com/showATL. You can give a one-time donation or a recurring donation. All funds will be used to make this show better and better and better for you. So we would greatly appreciate that. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for supporting us. Thank you again for being a part of the conversation that we continue to have day in and day out to make our city a better place, a more creative place. We will catch you next time. Thank you. Goodbye.